Good evening. The United Kingdom begins its mass COVID-19 vaccination program. Did Trump blow the deal with Pfizer? A damning report on sexual assault in the army. More on Biden's war cabinet and 40 years since the murder of John Lennon in New York. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Tuesday, December 8th, 2020. A 90-year-old woman, Margaret Keenan, was the first person to receive an injection of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine at University Hospital in Coventry on Tuesday. The United Kingdom is the first country in the world to approve the coronavirus vaccine, paving the way for mass vaccination in the country. The first people to be vaccinated will be priority groups, including healthcare workers, the elderly, and those who have an underlying health condition. In the United States, President-elect Joe Biden announced his healthcare team today, starting with his nominee for Secretary of Health and Human Services after a stumble or two.
For Secretary of Health and Education Services, I nominated Javier Baccaria. Javier Becerra. He currently, the Attorney General of California, leading the second largest Justice Department in America, only behind the United States Department of Justice. And for nearly 25 years before that, he was a congressman representing Los Angeles, one of the largest, America's largest and most diverse cities. Javier spent a career fighting to expand access to health care, reducing racial health disparities, protecting the Affordable Care Act, and take on powerful special interests to prey on profit off of people's health, from opioid manufacturers to big tobacco. He's also the first Latino leading HHS, the son of a working class immigrant family that came from Mexico, a true public servant who's dedicated his career in the service of the people and the service of this country that we all love.
Biden laid out three goals for the first 100 days of his administration's COVID-19 response, requiring masks in all federal facilities and getting 100 million vaccinated, despite what he says is the Trump administration's failure to be prepared.
Our preliminary view of Trump administration's vaccine distribution plans confirms media reports. Without urgent action by this Congress this month to put sufficient resources into vaccine distribution and manufacturing, which the bipartisan group is working on, there's a real chance that after an early round of vaccinations, the effort will slow and stall. We also need the Trump administration to act now, though, to purchase the doses it has negotiated with Pfizer and Moderna, and to work swiftly to scale manufacturing to U.S. populations and the world. This can be fixed. If it is fixed, my team will be able to get at least 100 million vaccinations done in my first 100 days. The third thing I'm going to ask in the 100 days, it should be a national priority to get our kids back into school and keep them in school.
President-elect Joe Biden. Biden says he consulted on the vaccine plan with Dr. Anthony Fauci, who has agreed to sign on as an advisor. As Biden was speaking, outgoing President Donald Trump held his own coronavirus news conference at the White House, where he thanked his team, leaving out Fauci, who has played a prominent role on the coronavirus task force. Trump answered one question. Was he coordinating with the incoming administration? Trump answered by saying he is the incoming administration.
Well, we're going to have to see who the next administration is, because we won in those swing states, and there was terrible things that went on. So we're going to have to see who the next administration is. But whichever the next administration is, will really benefit by what we've been able to do with this incredible science, the doctors, all of the people that came up, the lab technicians. The work that's been done is incredible. And it will be incredible for the next administration. And hopefully the next administration will be the Trump administration, because you can't steal hundreds of thousands of votes. You can't have fraud and deception and all of the things that they did, and then slightly win a swing state And you just have to look at the numbers, look at what's been on tape, look at all the corruption, and we'll see. You can't win an election like that. So hopefully the next administration will be the Trump administration, a continuation. We were rewarded with a victory. Now let's see whether or not somebody has the courage, whether it's a legislator or legislatures, or whether it's a justice of the Supreme Court or a number of justices of the Supreme Court. Let's see if they have the courage to do what everybody in this country knows is right. When the numbers came out, and the numbers came through machines, and all of those ballots were taken away and added, all you have to do is turn on your local television set and you'll see what happened, with thousands of ballots coming out from under tables, with all of the terrible things you saw. All you have to do is take a look. And if somebody has the courage, I know who the next administration will be.
Meanwhile, Trump shrugged off concerns about holding the White House Christmas party during a pandemic. Video posted by a guest at a party last Tuesday showed minimal mask usage. Jenna Ellis, a Trump campaign legal advisor, tested positive for COVID-19, as is Trump's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, who was hospitalized yesterday. Meanwhile, the New York Times reports the Trump administration missed a chance to lock in millions of doses more than the 100 million it bought for $1.95 billion or $19.50 a dose. Pfizer was one of six contracts the Trump administration signed with vaccine makers to hedge its bets on which vaccine would be ready first. But after Pfizer signed its federal contract in late July, it sealed a deal with the European Union to acquire 200 million doses. White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany says the Times report is false.
According to the people involved in the negotiation, it just simply was not true. This president contracted for doses of this vaccine from many different companies, 100 million doses, and those involved in the negotiation say it's just simply not true.
White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany. Trump also signed an executive order today applying his America First philosophy, proclaiming other nations won't get the U.S. vaccine supplies or any U.S. vaccine supplies until Americans have been inoculated. The United States has also declined to participate in international efforts to supply low-income countries with vaccines. And Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy says 14 military leaders will face disciplinary action after an independent review prompted by the death of soldier Vanessa Guillen. Vanessa Guillen was a 20-year-old U.S. Army soldier who was murdered last April inside a Fort Hood, Texas armory by another enlisted soldier. The review found the command climate at the Texas military base created a permissive environment for sexual assault and sexual harassment. Secretary McCarthy says he's disappointed in the report's findings and says it will cause the Army to change our culture.
Tragic death of Vanessa Guillen and a rash of other challenges at Fort Hood forced us to take a critical look at our systems, our policies, and ourselves. I've determined the issues at Fort Hood are directly related to leadership failures. I am gravely disappointed that leaders failed to effectively create a climate that treated all soldiers with dignity and respect, and they failed to reinforce everyone's obligation to prevent and properly respond to allegations of sexual harassment and sexual assault. Because of this, to restore trust and confidence and accountability, I directed the relief and or suspension of commanders and other leaders from the Corps to the squad level. I have directed the relief of the 3 Corps Deputy Commanding General for support, the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment Command Team, and suspended the 1st Cavalry Division Command Team, pending the results of a new investigation into the command climate of the division. In total, 14 leaders have been relieved or suspended from their positions. In addition, we are directing an investigation regarding Criminal Investigation Command resourcing policies and procedures. Accountability and transparency are foundational as we move forward.
Army Secretary Ryan McCarthy. A bill in honor of Guillen is being considered in Washington, D.C. If passed, the I Am Vanessa Guillen bill would allow active duty members to file sexual harassment and assault claims to a third party. In more military news, President-elect Biden is expected to nominate retired General Lloyd J. Austin III, a former commander of the American military effort in Iraq, to be the next Secretary of Defense. General Austin, 67, would make history as the first African-American to lead the country's 1.3 million active-duty troops. He's the only African-American to have headed U.S. Central Command, the combat command with responsibility for Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, and most of the places where the United States is at war. Peace activist Jody Williams, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997 for her work banning anti-personnel mines, says she's disappointed by Biden's reported pick for the defense spot. She says it's more of the same.
I think it's really dangerous that Biden is continuing on this path instead of reversing it like he said he was going to. I've been looking at the U.S. discretionary budget a lot lately, and over 57% of the discretionary budget goes to the military, and something like 5% goes to the State Department. Just looking at that, what does that tell you about the focus of foreign policy in this country? If he is continuing with Trump's trend of more and more nominations of former military, he's just strengthening the military perspective on foreign policy, which I think is dangerous. It reminds me of several countries that I worked in the 1980s.
What were those?
Nicaragua, El Salvador. The military was running everything. So if Biden keeps on nominating military people to what are supposed to be traditionally civilian positions, to me, it projects an image of the overimportance of the military in all parts of U.S. policy.
Is that going to be any difference from how things have been done up till now?
It makes one wonder about Biden's words. If he said when he was running that he was going to rebalance the civilian-military relationship, and then he's nominating many military people, then he's, I don't want to say lying, but what happened in between the words he spoke and the actions he's taking is my question. You know, I don't really care what you say. I care what you do. And what he is doing is just continuing the strengthening of military in positions in the government where they should not be.
Don't most Americans like that? They respect and love their military and like the idea that military people and not politicians like Trump are running things.
By nominating military to what should be civilian positions, you're politicizing the military. And we have always been proud of the fact that our military is apolitical, it doesn't interfere in politics, etc. But with this continuation of the Trumpian policy, I don't feel particularly thrilled. And I think most Americans are rather ignorant about the military anyway.
Do you think this will lead to more conflicts under Biden?
God, I hope not. Not necessarily. But for me, it's not just the willingness to go to war, which, of course, the U.S. has been willing to do since its inception. It's about the politicization of the military. I like them as a neutral entity that is under civilian leadership and control. And that seems to be, you know, wearing away.
Peace activist Jody Williams, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1997 for her work banning anti-personnel landmines. To be nominated, General Austin, who retired 4 years ago, would have to get a congressional waiver of a rule preventing soldiers from holding top government jobs until they're 7 years out of the military. It's not assured that approval would be coming. A former combat veteran in Iraq and Afghanistan is Matthew Ho. He's senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. He says General Austin is a continuation of America's longstanding warlike posture.
Certainly he's qualified in the sense that Washington, D.C. views people as qualified. You know, it doesn't matter that he was the commanding general for the disastrous wars that started when he was in charge of Central Command, or that he was intimately involved with the wars in Iraq or Afghanistan. It's about what they call experience. And so in that sense, he had 41 years in uniform. He is on the board of directors for Raytheon. He has ties and connections to all the right people. For Washington, D.C., what counts is whether or not you have a glaring conflict of interest. And also your resume reads like a catalog of failures. It seems as if he was chosen due to his identity more than anything else, though. It's great that we have diversity, but diversity is supposed to bring change. Diversity is supposed to broaden what people understand and the perspective people bring. Diversity is supposed to allow for new opportunities and new ways of thinking. And unfortunately, what we're seeing with the Biden administration, not just in Austin's pick, but across the board, particularly in national security and foreign policy, is citing diversity, citing that there are so many women and so many people of color. But that diversity brings nothing new or nothing changed to decades of American foreign policy and war policy that have really just brought ruin and suffering to so many.
What is this going to mean? I mean, he's Central Command, so there's been some movement away from Afghanistan and Iraq. There's been at least rhetoric about that. Do you expect that to change under this guy?
The Biden administration will be like much of what we've seen since the end of the Bush administration, with the exception of, say, President Obama's escalation of the war in Afghanistan in 2009, 2010. With that lone exception, we've seen a desire by administrations, as well as the Pentagon, to have less of a footprint, to have less American soldiers actually in the fighting, and to rely more on American firepower, American aircraft and drones, and then to use proxy forces. You can see that General Austin is not just a proponent of this, but an architect of this. Civilian casualties in Afghanistan caused by United States bombing were up 330% over the last 4 years. That wasn't unique to Afghanistan. The reason why it started in 2016, that increase, was because that's when the aircraft and the drones were shifted from Syria and Iraq to Afghanistan. In 2013, 2014, you saw this mass bombing of Syria and Iraq with very little U.S. ground forces involved, mainly just special operations and some training personnel. Austin was at that time head of Central Command, which was responsible for the wars in Iraq and Syria, as well as the wars in Yemen and other places. Austin has very real experience in expanding these wars in terms of escalating them through firepower and dropping more bombs, as well as then using proxy forces, whether they say be Shia militias in Iraq, Kurdish groups in Syria, or the Afghan government itself in Afghanistan.
Where do you think this is all going to go as far as Biden?
It's either going to remain the same if levels are aggressive enough and the U.S. has a dominating presence. The potential for war is about the same with a Biden administration as it has been all through this century.
Matthew Ho is a former combat veteran in Iraq and Afghanistan. General Austin is currently on the board of directors of the Raytheon Corporation, a major defense contractor. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. A Brooklyn ultra-Orthodox sect that's openly flouted coronavirus public health measures for months could soon lose its Williamsburg headquarters once and for all, Mayor Bill de Blasio threatened on Tuesday. A funeral drew hundreds of largely unmasked observers to the Satmar community's main Williamsburg synagogue at 152 Rodney Street. De Blasio was asked about the gathering today.
See a pattern of violation, that's what could lead to a full shutdown. But we've got to have facts, and we're also going to have a serious conversation with the community leaders about why this keeps being a question mark instead of it being abundantly clear that things have to be handled very cautiously and carefully for this last phase of fighting the coronavirus, that we can't take chances. We got to have that clear conversation again, and then it's up to them to follow the rules that are quite obvious to all of us.
De Blasio says New York is in the last phase of the pandemic, leading to the time when a vaccine is expected to eventually eliminate the disease. Governor Andrew Cuomo said yesterday more restrictions are almost certain as the numbers of hospitalized COVID patients begins to tax hospital capacity.
Based on the indicators that we're looking at, and I know the governor and the state are watching these indicators all the time, it's important to recognize that we've gone through a really tough stretch here over the last few weeks. And unless there is some evidence that that is going to change rapidly, unfortunately, restrictions are needed to protect us all. So we're constantly talking to the state about this. I think everyone is aligned that we've got to stop this increase we're seeing. We've got to protect everyone in the city, and particularly do that by protecting our hospitals. And we got to link up to the vaccine being distributed so that we can really turn the corner once and for all. So I think there is urgency here, and we're talking to the state daily. But I think what's clear is, you know, you're going to see these restrictions in a matter of days.
And a recent Supreme Court case invalidated the state rules on religious gatherings recently, but the court's decision doesn't affect houses of worship in areas like Williamsburg that are outside the color-coded COVID zones. In the past, de Blasio has stopped short of closing major synagogues that were in violation of COVID regulations. 400 years ago, the first European settlers to enter what's now called New York Harbor settled not on the big island we now call Manhattan, but on a small chunk of rock in the harbor. Back then, they called it Nut Island. Today, it's a former military base turned park known as Governor's Island. Community activists say the inviting patch of green is under assault by Mayor de Blasio, who's proposing a center for climate resiliency for parts of the 172-acre park. The mayor wants to rezone parts of the island for high-rise commercial and residential buildings. The chair of the Tribeca Trust and president of Human Scale New York is Lynn Ellsworth. She says New York needs more parks, not luxury housing.
We don't need to develop Governor's Island into just some big shebang. It's public space. It's, you know, it's a public thing, combined city, state, and federal ownership of the land. So there's no need to do something. It's not a private place. It's been very successful in its reinvention, you know, as it was transformed from basically a place where a military base to a public park. Why take out 33 acres of it for something fantastical that is likely never to happen? The proposal is kind of a bait-and-switch model.
What do you mean by bait-and-switch?
Step one, you propose that what you're really doing is some great, wonderful, public good thing. It's the red herring, and you dangle it in front of everybody who gets all confused talking about that thing. So in this case, the red herring bait is a center for climate resiliency, and then which the city would have absolutely no idea what that actually is. And then Alicia Gunn says, well, upzone it so I can sell off and develop the buildings, and then we'll find people to come and occupy them and rent them and pay property taxes to the city. And if you do this, I'll figure out a way to eventually have $120 million in leases and property taxes from whoever I can get to move in.
What is the next step? What's the fight that's happening?
The mayor is steamrolling it through. As he's doing, this administration is behaving kind of like a defeated army in retreat, where they try to do as much damage as they leave.
How is the mayor actually trying to railroad this through?
They're doing the ULURP process now. It's already been certified, so it's already happening. And as you know, or as many of your listeners know, once ULURP is certified and begins, it's merely a process of public consultation. It's a done deal. Nothing is changed. Nothing happens. Sometimes they tinker on the edges for political public relations purposes. See, we changed something after the public review process.
So what's the next step?
The community board, one, is reviewing it. They will vote on it and issue a resolution next week, I believe.
And you expect them to approve it?
No, I do not. I think that there's a lot of people on community board, one, who think it's totally ridiculous and absurd beyond belief. And, you know, there's
How
nothing
about
wrong
Margaret
with
Chin?
She's all on board. She's on the trust. She's one of the, like, public council member who sits on the board of this trust for the Governor's Island. So she's part of the problem.
So city council people always get what they want?
They generally do. They usually get what they want. So unless you elect a different council member, and unless it can be defeated in court or some other way.
Margaret Chin, what about her?
She's termed out. She's very pro-development. She pretty much does whatever de Blasio asks her to do. She's a real loyalist to de Blasio. We actually have no leverage over her anyway now. It doesn't matter if we hate her and tell her not to do this. She'll do whatever she feels like.
What are you expecting? What do you guys want to do? What are you trying to do?
If we can point out the financial boondoggle character of this, that it could never really work, you might get some dissent in the city council. I noticed that in the Flushing rezoning, Francesco Moyo led a whole bunch of city council members to write a letter to all their colleagues saying, we shouldn't do this. We shouldn't do the Flushing rezoning. This is not right at this point, which is an unprecedented thing to have happen, I believe. And I think that maybe the rest of the city council can be mustered to say, this is a stupid seizure of public land for a highly speculative venture that will probably end up costing us more than we get in the next 10, 20 years. And it should be a low-key public park. And there's nothing wrong with like low-key redevelopment of the little site.
Lynn Ellsworth is chair of the Tribeca Trust and president of Human Scale New York. Imagine, a song written and performed by John Lennon. It was 40 years ago today. An assassin murdered the former Beatle outside of his home at the Dakota on the Upper West Side. Always at home in New York, John and his wife, Yoko Ono, went about their business without security as usual. Lennon loved the cool anonymity of the city, where even the famous could walk the streets unmolested. But outside of his home on West 72nd Street in Central Park West, killer Mark David Chapman was waiting. He approached and asked Lennon to sign a copy of his recent album, Double Fantasy. Lennon signed it and went on with his day. Later that night, when Lennon and Yoko returned to say goodnight to their son, Sean, Chapman was waiting with a handgun. John Lennon would have turned 80 this year. Mark David Chapman is in an upstate prison where he's been regularly denied parole. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, December 8th, 2020. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson from New York City for the WBAI News. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.